You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities, and the Mystery of Golgotha, 12 lectures, and they were translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 6, given on 18th of April, 1916. It seems a difficult thing to engage in Easter reflections in the way one might in other less grave times and circumstances. Nevertheless, today I will share some thoughts with you about the approaching festival. In recent lectures, we have spoken of various things that have a strong connection with the Easter festival, or also with the Easter service, even though no mention was made of their relationship with it. We spoke of how human culture and cultural evolution, insofar as it is spiritual in nature, is informed by a wide range of associations and brotherhoods that express their solidarity in the form of symbolic rites and actions, and that these in turn are drawn from certain imaginative conceptions. The most important symbol of such societies is connected with the idea of death and resurrection. It repeatedly becomes apparent that these fraternities connect the idea of human death and that of resurrection in a way that together gives rise to that of immortality. The things to be considered here are often regarded as these societies' secret rites, and yet there is now such a wealth of literature with extensive details about the rites of these fraternities, conveyed in images, at least, that we can say a great deal about their symbolic content, without in any way violating their secrecy. The things I wish to discuss have been published in countless books. All this is centered, one can say, on a symbolic representation of circumstances in which a person is led toward death, dies, and is buried. In most of these fraternities, the human individual to whom this symbolic context relates is regarded as Hiram, and this context is therefore called the Hiram legend. Hiram, the master builder of the Temple of Solomon, whom the legend states built it in association with King Solomon, and was then killed by certain enemies who were subordinates of his, is seen in the symbolic context of this death. First, his burial is depicted, and subsequently, this leads to a certain form of resurrection from the grave, Hiram's emergence from the grave. By means of this symbolic context, efforts are made to impress upon the soul the idea of immortality in a more comprehensive or incisive way than is possible through merely theoretical considerations. In symbols or imaginative pictures that elicit a person's unconscious powers, they seek to show the nature of the passage through death and resurrection. If we consider that Hiram's death and resurrection is represented in the temples of these societies, their lodges, then we already find here a connection with the Easter thought. As you know, Catholic rites also contain a symbolic representation, in which after the Maundy Thursday festival, Good Friday follows, and symbolically Christ is then laid in the grave. Contemplation of Christ Jesus in the grave continues through Easter Saturday, until, according to more recent customs, the resurrection is celebrated on the evening of Easter Saturday, That is, the Christ arises from the grave and his resurrection is celebrated. If we consider these Catholic rituals with their symbolic content, we find that they are really fully equivalent to the burial and resurrection of Hiram in occult brotherhoods. You could see, therefore, that the Easter thought is in a sense at the very center of these occult brotherhoods. The meaning connected with this ceremony is that a person can enter more deeply into his inner self, in a sense invoking the deeper powers that lie there and are not present in ordinary awareness. A symbolic rite of this kind would have no meaning if it were not assumed that powers exist in the depths of the human soul where consciousness does not delve. Anyone who gives credence to human accomplishments that cannot originate in ordinary consciousness must assume that such powers exist, and this includes, for instance, anyone who is serious about art. What empowers the artist to create works of art cannot, it is generally said, originate in the soul's ordinary conscious powers. It must bubble up from the subconscious and enter conscious awareness. This is why an artist will often have little patience with rules and guidelines for his work. He cannot be governed by such things, but must open himself to the elemental powers that give wing to his sensibility. It may be that he can afterward embark on some kind of explanation of what underlies his soul's creative activity. Thus, we must assume that many other hidden powers hold sway in the soul and do not surface in our conscious mind. We can say, as we often have, that the human being's astral life is far, far more extensive in scope and breadth than our conscious ego life, and that these powers surface out of astrality into conscious experience. That, in other words, they exist below in a subterranean realm. In our time, a very great number of people have gradually adapted to a purely outward material life, and there seek their whole raison d'être. Even in their inner life of soul, basically, there is nothing but habituation to this outward material existence, which is the conscious realm. Our present conscious life on earth does need to develop under a material influence and is bound up with material life. This is why I have often said that what seeks to live in our awareness under the influence of our outward surroundings does not pass through the gate of death, but after a soul has passed through death can live on only in the memory of another I, capital, and gleams out when this person in turn passes through the gate of death. I'm going to read that sentence again. This is why I have often said that what seeks to live in our awareness under the influence of our outward surroundings does not pass through the gate of death, but after a soul has passed through death can live on only in the memory of another I, and gleams out when this person in turn passes through the gate of death. There, below in subconscious depths, therefore, a different kind of life holds sway, if a person has not accustomed himself to merely outward material life, as a great many people have today. And we can certainly notice the difference. If one shows people who are oriented only to outward material life a symbolic representation of, say, the death and rebirth of Hiram, they may even laugh at it, find it funny, something superfluous and pointless. But those who feel and sense something by drawing on the subconscious powers of soul that hold sway in the astral realm will be deeply moved by such a symbol, invoking in their soul the capacities that can understand immortality. Ordinary powers bound up with physical life cannot, by contrast, understand this idea. Now, the Easter festival preserves something of what was connected with the whole idea of a festival in humanity's primordial awareness. We have often spoken of this. When do we celebrate Easter? People with a materialistic outlook have often sought to change the way the time of the Easter festival is determined, thinking it is a nuisance if the date keeps altering every year. It can come at the end of March or the beginning of April, or even at the end of April. Modern people think it should always be celebrated on a fixed date, say the first Sunday in April, so that account books are not disrupted by Easter falling at different times every year. Let us not forget, of course, that a materialistic outlook is indeed connected with keeping accounts. I have nothing against account books, but I do, naturally, object a good deal to the materialistic outlook. Something can be perfectly good in itself, but this does not mean that other related things always have to be governed by it. For the time being at least, though this will change, there is still a sense that the Easter festival ought not to fall on the first Sunday in April, but should be established in accordance with certain cosmic circumstances, the reciprocal positions of sun and moon. If you go out in the evening at the moment and there's a clear sky, you can feel what the shining full moon means for human sensibility. Easter is celebrated on the Sunday after the first spring full moon, or in other words, after the full moon following the beginning of spring on 21 March. Thus the date of Easter is determined by relationships between the sun and moon, so that a festival celebrated here on Earth is made dependent on conditions in the cosmos. In setting the date of the Easter festival in this way, the human soul declares implicitly that not everything here on earth should be governed by earthly circumstances, but that what most deeply affects the soul should orient itself to super-terrestrial conditions. The human being is directed toward the symbols of immortality, burial, and resurrection. In images, whether in ritual pictures as in Catholic worship, or in more conceptual form as in other confessions, humankind is presented with the idea of life's immortality, the passage of the soul through the gate of death. But this picture of burial and resurrection is to hold sway in our soul at the time when sun and moon stand in the corresponding position, as we can always see from the calendar. This is a protest by the human soul that such an important symbolic context ought not to unfold under merely earthly circumstances. It is a recognition that contemplation of these symbols must be related to cosmic, superterrestrial conditions. Let us ask ourselves whether this idea is founded on a reality. Because of the temptations and misguidance of our materialistic age, we tend not to engage enough with the thought of true reality. The more materialistic people are today, the more they give themselves up to the hallucination that they are contemplating reality. Why are people such materialists? It is because they do not recognize the reality of anything that is not material. People have a materialistic outlook because they delude themselves that they know reality. Yet basically, it is true to say that nothing diverts us so much from reality as materialism. A simple thought can bring this home to us. You are all sitting here and listening to what I am saying. Now, what I have just said is not as dire as other things I have said elsewhere. Dire for a materialistic thinker, I mean. Let us assume that instead of you, this audience, the room is full of materialistic thinkers, for instance, a band of monists. If this were so, Surely something quite different would be passing through human souls as I speak, if this were a gathering of monists listening instead of you. Why is this? If you consider realities, what lives in souls, you will have to acknowledge that if a crowd of monists were sitting here, something quite different would occur. Why? You will admit that in purely abstract hypothetical terms, though not in reality, one could also say that your karma might have led you to join a band of monists rather than to be here. This is not so, of course. The whole thing is hypothetical and an unreal assumption, though one we can make in the abstract. But given this assumption, it would not be too far-fetched to say that within your body something quite different would be listening than is presently listening in you, since you have absorbed various aspects of spiritual science. Truly, what we develop over the course of our lives always also listens in us, always also resonates. And one can say that with many or most of you, something is also listening that has lived its way into your soul over the course of the time that you have spent within the stream of spiritual science. We continually become a little different through the life we lead and the experiences we have. But to speak in this way of people in the abstract is unreal. Speaking of the human being in general has no reality at all. The moment we engage with realities, we discover how unreal we are, if, as so commonly today, we speak only in anthropological rather than anthroposophical terms. Now, it is easy for you to overlook this, to fail to see the effect upon your soul of spiritual science. But your soul is also formed by a very great many other things. A great deal informs the nature of human souls. And here you need only consider how a subconscious, astral nature is connected with the human soul. And then you will see that what plays into your soul from the outer world, without your awareness, which remains in the subconscious, may be the most significant and powerful factor. Sometimes people allow a quiet awareness to resonate in them, something also of an infinitely sweet and loving awareness of the fact that much that is not even earthly in nature plays into their under psyche. Who of us does not know delightful, beautiful poems, love poems, that relate to the shining light of the moon, which testify to a quiet, sweet sense that this under psyche, the unconscious soul, is connected with non-earthly realities that shimmer and gleam from and in the moonlight? Try to call before your soul the lyric poetry that speaks of lovers walking in the moonlight, and how in so much of this there quietly and sweetly resonates the fine weaving of the silver moonlight. And no one will try to claim, surely, that the human soul, with in this respect its coarser, upper consciousness, can say what exactly it is in the moonshine that wafts and weaves through this soul. A hardened materialist will, of course, say that the moon has nothing at all to do with these loving feelings. But today we will not engage further with objections of such a nature. But instead, let us trust more in the quiet, sweet surfacing into awareness of what the lyric poets have spoken and sung. Here we can say that something like a ray of cosmic superterrestrial reality shines into our awareness and is related to the subconscious weaving and working of the human soul. If you recall what was said on Thursday and again at the public lecture on Saturday about the working and weaving of the folk soul element into human soul life, then you will have to acknowledge that this folk soul element also holds sway much more in the subconscious than in conscious awareness. You see, the working of the folk soul element that often rises up from the subconscious into consciousness and is formulated in ideas and concepts is also of this nature. That is simply so. Truly, an important part of what holds sway in the depths of our soul and rises to resonate quietly in our conscious awareness, what holds sway there in the astral body, is not earthly. Someone whose soul is open to impressions of the world of spirit knows that our earth is different in spring and autumn, not solely because vegetation burgeons in spring and is harvested in autumn, but because the region of the earth upon which the moonlight shines is different from the region when it is not moon illumined. Instead of thinking that it is just a silver ball or silver sickle floating in the heavens, we must picture a tissue of light surrounding us, a spiritual fabric in which we ourselves live, weave, and swim with our souls, in the same way that our bodies can swim in water. And what weaves and lives in or around the earth keeps changing, depending on the changing relationship between the moon and the sun. After 21 March, the sun stands in a quite different relationship to the earth than before this date. And the sunlight that shines back to us from the moon to the earth is therefore also quite different in quality after 21 March than it is before then. The first full moon after the beginning of spring, which gives us back the first strength of the resurrected sun, is something different from every other full moon. Our astral nature would therefore not be the same if, let us say, it looked upon the symbol of burial and resurrection in December rather than during the week after the spring full moon. Our soul is something quite different at this time. If our soul becomes different to a small degree by our absorption of spiritual science, as opposed to monist outlooks, so it becomes substantially different in the moonlight after the spring equinox from what it is after the winter solstice. Thus our soul can experience something different at this time than at another. Oh, my dear friends, if only people would consider what the human being actually is and what he is connected with, they would then speak of the divine nature within them with enormous piety. And doing so would not make them arrogant, but very humble. For it would become clear to them how very much is necessary in the world so that this being they find themselves to be can stand here in the world. When spiritual science appears today, one of the many reasons for it doing so is to widen the human being's scope of vision, a vision that has become so constricted through materialistic developments. The soul's thinking, feeling, and will, its whole sensibility, really is widened when one absorbs spiritual science authentically. People today fail to realize that materialistic developments in humanity have not only brought what is called materialism, but above all, also a curtailment of our thought life. Our thoughts have all become small, and they must grow great again. Amongst humankind, it must again become possible to see things in much broader contexts. In everything connected with the arts, for instance, in which a person also includes himself in the material on which he works, and that is ultimately true of almost all the arts, I wish that people would feel this, that an idea drawn from spiritual science, such as the one we highlighted last Saturday, really can lead us to deeper understanding. Just consider what it means if we can realize that we consist of two parts, a head standing at a much later evolutionary stage, already more hardened than the rest of the organism, and the latter standing at a less advanced evolutionary stage. Consider all that can emerge from this for the interplay between this human organism, apart from the head and the head itself. Whenever we move our hand, we perform a movement, and underlying this is the etheric body that accomplishes it. What happens when I move my hands? I have previously described this here. The physical hands and the etheric hands accomplish the same movements. Whenever I think, the left and right cerebral lobes, as etheric head, also perform movements. And these are very similar to my hand movements. But the physical part is chained, enclosed in the fixed skull, a Prometheus bound. And this is the basis for thinking. If not through external constraint, but through organic enchainment, the human being were as he will be when Earth has passed away, and the Jupiter stage of evolution arrives, when his arms will be as bound as his cerebral lobes are now, what would remain of the movements of the hands would be thinking. But I wish to use a much more tangible example to show something that can clarify a few things, specifically in relation to modern times. The thoughts of the best figures of our age have been curtailed so that they survey only a small span of space and time, as opposed to the broad scope that we need, a larger scale of thinking that can survey much more. Let me give you an example. By his own view, Edward von Hartmann, the philosopher of the unconscious, was certainly not a materialist. Yet this self-appraisal is of less importance than discerning whether our actual habits of thought are materialistic. One can establish an entirely idealistic philosophy and yet still have material habits of thinking. And these habits of thought will then determine whether our ideas are limited or of much broader scope. Now, alongside some useful philosophical works, Edward von Hartmann has also written on politics. I will cite him in this context, since in his day he was really greatly esteemed as a political writer. In the most eminent sense, we must call him one of the greatest German or Prussian patriots. No one can doubt that Edward von Hartmann held these patriotic views if they read certain published letters he wrote about what happened in 1866. Quote, "And although the Danish War and what followed from it inevitably took an unfortunate course, I believe that Prussia must become dominant within Germany, simply because the evolution of ideas necessitates this." Close quote. We can therefore regard Edward von Hartmann as one of the most dedicated patriots. In the 1880s, in 1889, he wrote some very fine essays about the general situation in Europe. They were widely read at the time, and of course suffered the same fate to which all writing succumbs today, whether it is good or bad. Things are read and forgotten. I don't believe that what he wrote 30 years ago is still read very much. As a political commentator, he did not start from abstract and idealistic ideas. This is something he was also esteemed for, but he was, as you can see from numerous reviews of his work, a person who espoused realpolitik, in other words, someone who reckoned with actual circumstances. Naturally, Edward von Hartmann's ideas were sufficiently broad in scope to encompass the constellation of the various great powers of Europe, Germany, Austria, Italy, France, England, Russia, and then all the small neutral states between them. And he was painstaking in his research when writing an essay on the diverse political interests of these various states. In a noteworthy essay he wrote in 1888, which appeared in book form in 1889, he reflected on the best possible potential political constellation for Europe. As I said, he was a real patriot, not just for Germany, but for a wider Prussia, and was therefore, of course, speaking from this standpoint. He conceived of alliances he thought should be formed, considering that Germany, and a Europe encompassing as powerful a Germany as possible, would best be served by an alliance under English leadership between Switzerland, Belgium, Holland, as an alliance of shared neutrality. He thought this would be the surest means to create conditions that a German and Prussian patriot would most ardently wish for. And this was back in 1889. Switzerland, Belgium, and Holland united under English leadership. I beg you to consider this most seriously, and compare it with what people are now obliged to say after this only half came about prior to the war. Belgium under England's leadership. Edward von Hartmann wanted to see Belgium, Switzerland, and Holland under England's leadership. It is interesting to see such a tangible example. And if we considered all areas of life, we could find countless examples of these and similar circumstances, of how people were thinking 30 years ago, and to ask what intelligent people are thinking today. Everyone is intelligent, of course, these days. But how far-reaching is the scope of their ideas? How long will they remain true? And surely the important thing about an idea is that it exists within and relates to reality, that our thinking can realize our actions in the world. I'm sure you can see where this is leading. The whole materialistic evolution of our age curtails human thoughts, renders them of use in temporal terms for no more than 2 or 3 decades. There is no point in employing such short-term thinking when we need to consider longer periods of time. Political views, such as those of Edward von Hartmann, appear outdated after 30 years. And if one writes a book on Hartmann, one may no longer even need to consider them. You see, a fair number of books are written today without considering all the factors that should be considered. But in another domain, we really do need to consider a longer duration, for example, in the realm of medicines. Views about medicines are not as easy to evaluate as political judgments, and yet the philosopher Lotze, who is thoroughly conversant with medicine, was quite right to say that the enthusiasm accompanying the development of a new medicine today usually lasts only 5 years or so. Not only does this enthusiasm fade after this period, but along with it also the huge popularity that first greeted it. People do notice this a little more than they notice it with political views. Gustav Theodor Fechner, a witty and intelligent man, wrote a very interesting treatise in the 1820s, at a time when a new medicine, iodine, had just arrived on the scene. People started to list all the countless conditions and disorders that iodine could be used to treat. Fechner wrote a neat little essay in which he applied all the rules of science to prove that the moon is made of iodine, and that one therefore need only devise a method for capturing moonlight, and would then be able to use this wonderful universal panacea. Later, as you know, Gustav Theodor Fechner established a scientific conception of aesthetics, founded psychophysics, and was also an outstanding physicist. So we do not need to see him as one of those dubious theosophists, do we? Even people who have more than half a foot in the monist camp take Fechner seriously. Those with both feet in it, on the other hand, do not. Everywhere we come upon a certain curtailment of vision, a certain adherence to short-term views and ideas. This is true particularly wherever we find modern science raised from its proper domain into the realm of humanities, or what are called the humanities, and there employing the same methods. Yes, this is very dismal indeed, and the only way in which people can overlook this desolation is to stick with just one or two authors who write in the same vein, rather than perceiving the chaos and confusion that arises, for instance, if one considers a couple of differently minded authors, or researchers, as they like to call themselves. Try comparing two authors with different perspectives on what is called the, quote, psychology of nations, close quote. I'm sorry to say this, but you will be flabbergasted. Using the modern mode of thinking to study the various peoples of Europe in, of course, a purely scientific and objective manner, you will see that an author describes the people of Central Europe as Germanic or Norse in origin. Such an author then goes on to characterize the qualities of these people. But if we turn from him to a French author who describes the French nation, whose people are, as he has been informed, descended from the Celts, we will find that he ascribes to these ancient Celts the same characteristics that the other author ascribed to the Teutonic peoples. The only thing people are unaware of is that there is much more of a Celtic quality living in Central Europe than in French-speaking Western Europe. People do not know this. Indeed, we can encounter still more breathtaking assumptions. I could tell you about a well-known author, a commentator on national psychology, who, as other authors do, focuses on examples of individuals descended from a particular people or nation and illustrative of its qualities. This commentator refers to Byron. One can see he loves Byron. But this is only because, in considering him, he comes to the view that Byron was not really English at all, but really a German at heart. This is seriously stated in a book on national psychology. Byron is really a German. Another author, who probably likes Byron less, also writes about him, but finds him repellent because of his entirely Celtic characteristics. I could cite countless examples of this sort of thing, conflicting ideas that show how little substance they have. Certainly when modern so-called sure scientific methods are transposed into the domain of culture, the humanities, we quickly see how unreliable are the ideas that emerge from this. Just consider how necessary it is for the spirit to inform this realm. But how long will it be before we possess a soul science, as I tried to describe this in ideal terms last Thursday? And yet only a soul science of this kind can bring us an understanding of what really holds sway in Europe, and can also introduce the mutual understanding between peoples that is necessary if European culture is to continue. Much has been written in recent war months. Well, I'm not sure whether reading is the right use for all that has been written, but books by the Swede Kjellin are amongst relatively good things that have been written. There you will find a very positive assessment connected with current events, a judgment more general in character, which we can summarize as follows. In humanity's evolution, we have gradually developed an enormously material culture which comes to expression everywhere. The spiritual scientist, as I have often stated, has no need to disparage the greatness of this external material culture. But if we compare these material values with spiritual ones, we have to acknowledge that the latter are simply incapable of mastering and governing such an intensely materialistic culture. And this is the greatest plague of our time. Our incapacity to master and govern the products of material culture through spiritual values. It is here that spiritual science really must engender the necessary feelings, giving rise to the insight that we must not sin against the great spiritual laws of the cosmos. The prevailing truth demands its rights. Just conceive of any domain of life without spiritual values, however marvelously equipped in material terms. This materiality, whether of a state organization or other structure, will not thrive because the world is such that a soul is essential for every body. I can give you a tangible example of this, one that may be close to home for us. I am not speaking here of what anyone ought to do or think, just offering an illustrative instance. Within the Anthroposophical Society, we cultivate the science of the spirit, a whole range of characteristics make this anthroposophical society different from all other associations, and it cannot be like them, at least under certain circumstances. Why is this? What do other associations do when they are founded? They draw up programs, agreeing on certain planned courses of action. When one leaves such an association, one thereby states that one no longer agrees with its program. If the whole association is dissolved, no one is injured by the items on the plan or program, are they? One can form an association and dissolve it again, and this is true of every mechanism in the world. Weismann once tried to characterize the organism in scientific terms. Naturally, he only drew attention to a negative characteristic, yet it was true. What is the nature of life? Asked Weismann. It is what leaves a corpse behind when it departs. Naturally, this is not a description of life as such, but we have to acknowledge there is some truth in it, an accurate negative characterization of life as leaving a corpse behind when it has gone. Our anthroposophical society is really already a living entity by virtue of the fact that our members have in their hands now a certain number of lecture cycles, which, given the nature of the society at present, non-members usually do not get to see. But this means in turn that it is not so easy to leave either, for otherwise the person in question will take these lecture cycles away with him. But I did not wish to speak of this, for actually you can already buy these cycles in second-hand bookshops. Such things have occurred. And we must recognize that the Anthroposophical Society is an organism. You see, if the Anthroposophical Society were to be dissolved, it would leave a corpse behind. The lecture cycles exist. A different society structured on mechanical principles can dissolve itself without leaving any corpse. Its members go their different ways, and its programs and agendas are really not a residual corpse. As I said, we cannot contemplate reforms or such like in these present grave times. But what I mean is something else. Please do not think, my dear friends, that we can simply say that the society can go on existing, for why shouldn't it? In this case, it does not truly exist, does not truly live. If it lives in the assumption that lecture cycles cannot be found in second-hand bookshops, then if they can, after all, be found and bought there, it is not living in truth, in reality, but in a lie. That is quite self-evident. And to further spiritual science, truth, absolute truth, is needed. We can overlook this with our abstract thinking, but someone who knows that truth is a reality that works in the world cannot overlook it. When spiritual science becomes something we really feel inwardly, then we begin to see how every thought stands within reality, whereas abstract thinking, which accords with materialism, does not care how a thought relates to reality and stands within it. But it can be a curious experience if one tries to record in writing thoughts that live in reality. What is the nature of this experience? One finds that people regard these thoughts, at best, simply like anything else that can, say, be found printed in the newspaper, though perhaps not as long-winded an article as I read in the title Piccolo della Sera about some matter or other, bristling with indignation over three columns. But reading on, the whole thing was in turn repudiated. One did not have to wait for the next issue the following evening to find a repudiation of the article. It was there in the same edition. Things may not usually be so extreme, but as I said, the best you can hope for today when you try to present true, truthful thoughts, in other words, ones you not only believe but know to be in the domain of truth, is that they will merely be regarded like anything else. People read them as they read the things in newspapers, which are mostly only relevant for 24 hours. Yes, this awareness of our responsibility to live with our thoughts, in reality, is something that must come with spiritual science. And if the serious nature of our times is calling on us to develop one quality, it is this: to feel responsible for one's thoughts. My dear friends, all this shows how restricted thinking becomes if it limits itself only to the conscious realm, which initially is bound up with material reality. We should not be surprised, therefore, if the cultural streams in humanity's evolution, which must take a deeper hold than daily life does, also seek to take account of things that go deeper than ordinary consciousness. This has always been true of deeper religious impulses. Why did something like the Easter rites and services enter humanity's evolution? And why were these Easter rites connected with cosmology, with what occurs between sun and moon in the broad expanses of the heavens? It is because we would lapse into the most extreme short-sightedness in our feeling, thinking, and will if we were limited to our earthly experiences alone. We can only gain a broader view of life, can only make our thoughts more wide-ranging, if we not only integrate our physical eye consciousness into earthly experiences, but also our astral subconscious into the great cosmic events in the heavens. When the most important thought, that of immortality, is integrated with the cosmos, that truly has a good underlying reason in respect of religion. You see, if we only originated in earthly conditions, we could never even grasp the idea of immortality. If we were merely more developed apes, as scientific materialism would have it, there would be nothing in us that could conceive of this idea of immortality. I can actually give you a nice little example of the short-sightedness of scientists in this realm when they wax philosophical. A few days ago, I opened a book whose author, who may not be a monist as such, but might be, was writing in a materialistic vein about the connection between human beings and apes, though not in the justified sense that we have often discussed it. In one of his essays, at the very beginning of the book, this author states that he can give examples of travelers who, arriving in a certain region, have witnessed people whose culture had degenerated to such a degree that they displayed the same instincts and drives as apes. He goes on to say that if human beings can sink to the level of apes, can develop downward to ape-like behavior, then it is logical that the human being can likewise evolve from the ape. Self-evident, isn't it? Logical. We might just as well say that a person develops in his lifetime from a child to an old man, something we can see without traveling abroad. We can draw a parallel between a child becoming an old person and a person becoming ape-like through cultural degeneration. And it would be just as logical as this author's claim to say that an old man could turn back into a child. It is the very same logic. What is worrying is not so much the development of such shaky logic, but that all this is read by people, absorbed by them, without them noticing that it is based on utter drivel. We could never arrive at the idea of immortality if we were really connected only with earthly conditions, if our intrinsic being were only earthly. But whether through spiritual science or by some other means, we can connect the human being with the cosmos, with super-terrestrial realities, and then the idea of immortality can blossom in us. People can also come along and say that talking of super-terrestrial conditions is mere fantasy. That's possible. The human intellect can discount the spiritual element from its view of the human being, as monist materialism is seeking to do in all domains today. But the spiritual element cannot be sundered from the human soul, since we do not belong only to the earth, and are not composed only of earthly conditions. In a science and cultural orientation that limits human thoughts and feelings to earthly things, supersensible powers are, nevertheless, still present in the depths of the human soul, though people have to suppress this. And this will gradually give rise to the cultural illness of suppressed spirituality in the human soul. The times are serious, and we must seek to conceive this seriousness to the very greatest degree. But we will only rightly conceive what must hold sway in these grave times if we do not think only of the outward aspect, of what should come about through the hard trials of our times, but at the same time also recognize that these events must speak to us of a spiritual elevation of the whole human race. Only if a small number of people, at least, emerge from these grave times with the profound sense that humanity needs to be spiritualized, can these grave and challenging times of trial develop into something that accords with the spirit of the universe. Good will only follow from these events, whatever their outcome, if this is so. We only comprehend spiritual science if we see it not just as a Christmas annunciation, but an Easter one as well, in the sense of understanding the wider implications of the idea of immortality for the human being's whole nature. We can only grasp immortality if we comprehend the immortal aspect within us. Fichte, Hegel, and many others knew that the human soul does not become immortal only when it has passed through death, but is already immortal, and that this immortality is found within us. Therefore, we must seek a science that takes full spiritual soul account not only of the mortal body, but also the immortal human soul. It is quite natural that over the past 400 years, as science made such brilliant advances, human vision of the spiritual life has receded, along with an increasing disinclination to perceive the spirit in the outer world. But a time must come once more when Hiram, or as we say, that portion of Christ that is always with us and speaks to us of the supersensible, resurrects after being buried in the grave of cultural evolution's Holy Week. We can really see it like this. When the great Copernicus, the great Kepler, Galileo, and the rest appeared and directed human thoughts, as they had to the external world, this was the cosmic Maundy Thursday, which was followed by a Good Friday. Vision of immortality was buried. But now the time has come for the universal Easter Sunday, when we must celebrate the sacred resurrection of human soul and spirit knowledge. It is very fitting for us to have a Good Friday mood in our present times. But only if we find the strength to fit ourselves for the universal Easter Sunday will we be able to accomplish an inward Easter service in ourselves to accompany the outward rites and services. In Holy Week, we bear a black and grievous mood. The priests embody this mood in black mourning robes because the corpse of the dead Christ rests in the grave. Then comes the resurrection. Cordial, bright, spring garments replace the black clothes of mourning. At the moment, the thought of resurrection replaces that of the grave. It is fitting that we bear mourning and grief within us today. But let us fit ourselves to wear the spiritual garments of Easter when the times have once more changed. The end of Lecture 6.